Hello, neighbors. Welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Emke, your host. This is episode 30 of season 3. The show is brought to you by Kitchen Table Communications and the Voice of Bonbay Radio Network. And we are some stoked that season 3 is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. If you're a standard meat and potatoes person, or you're stuck in a rut getting all of your food from a grocery store, then it's time to get out of that cage and spread your wings. So today's special on the menu includes learning about the best time to eat knotweed, the joys of the first dandelion salad of the year, nettles, chickweed, alder, Dijon mustard, sea olives, and of course, mushrooms. But let me warn you about this topic. These foods may seem innocuous, but the search for them can take over your life. As my guest noted, it's like a book that I open that I can't ever put down. Today, we go down that rabbit hole of foraged foods, and we find many delights there.
My mom always gave me mushrooms in my stocking, and just mushrooms. Like, I just love mushrooms. Yeah, I don't know, since I was a kid, I just loved mushrooms that I would never buy now. Foraging wasn't a huge thing in Newfoundland, but Newfoundlanders did always harvest dandelions. Newfoundlanders are obsessed with tea, but I always hated tetley. I'm never a tea guy, but I love nettle teas and herbal teas and chaga tea and all those type of things. We could have enough dried, enough frozen, enough salted, enough pickled. You know, we could have a lot of food put away for ourselves. I think the more people are getting into hunting, foraging, fishing, all that stuff, it does really make me optimistic.
Sean Dawson is a forager, marketer, author, educator, supplier to the finest chefs of St. John's, food entrepreneur, and a generally practice-what-you-preach kind of fella. He's helping to bring back taste and appearance and reminds us that the art of culinary preparation can start in the forest or the beach or the headlands. He's a tour guide for all of us on our journey toward more local foods. However, he reminds us to look at what already grows here and then to redefine what we've been ignoring and cutting down and cursing to redefine it as the food that it actually is. Not just famine food, but high-end, tasty, nutrient-dense, easily available food. I met up with Sean in late January on a back road near Portugal Cove, St. Phillips. Move that cat from the chair and join us. Don't worry, the cat will be back on your lap in no time.
My name's Sean Dawson. We're in Portugal Cove, just on the back of an organic farm, a little piece of property I'm starting to turn into a homestead up here.
You're well known as a forager. Was there a point in your life where you said, this is going to be part of my career path?
Definitely was, but it's not when it started. I think I've just always been into it. I grew up on the southern shore going to my grandmother's Calvert. Yep. So me and my brother will be up there stealing plums and apples from the neighbors and picking mussels on the beach. And my nan would take me out berry picking whenever there was berries out. And she's always making things with it and stuff. So without knowing, I was always like, that was my passion. And I had such an interest in just going finding food. And I started farming when I moved to the Battery. I started a little farm down there. I moved into a really nice sheltered spot down there. I had an old greenhouse frame. At the time, I wanted to grow tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, everything like that. And I planted every single seed in the pack. So then I was bombarded with plants. And I started going to the farmer's market selling the plants. And then when the harvest came, I started selling the tomatoes and peppers. And then I got to meet a lot of chefs. Yeah. And then they found out I was really into mushrooms. So it kind of just happened where it's just like, oh, you guys buy mushrooms? And I started to bring them in, chanterelles and hedgehogs and all that type of stuff. And then I was like, do you buy plums and apples? And so it's always been a passion, but I had a landscape company at the time and I was doing that for a couple of years. And then I was like, man, I'm not enjoying my life and I love foraging and I'm so interested in food. And so I just completely dropped everything and went that route.
Mushrooms, did you forage those in Calvert when you were growing up?
No, not. My mom would tell me the complete opposite. Like whenever I'd be out picking berries or anything, it's like, leave mushrooms alone.
Leave mushrooms alone.
I think there was no tradition of picking mushrooms in Newfoundland. It's like, I think the Irish and English never really did that. I guess it just wasn't a thing when they came over here. Yeah. And like the Eastern Europeans and Germans and stuff started coming over here. That's when it started slowly catching on. Yep. Have you ever met a Newfoundlander that's been picking for 20 years? They've had a European friend that used to take them in the woods.
Mushrooms would be an area where it was really individuals who trained themselves and educated themselves
pretty much
moved it forward.
I remember my friend Hamish took me, he's from Scotland. I was farming and stuff at the time and I was always a mushroom nerd. Like, my mom always gave me mushrooms in my stocking and they just
mushrooms
always,
in your stocking
just
for Christmas
mushrooms. Yeah, like I just loved mushrooms.
She must have known.
I don't know. Since I was a kid, I just loved those
little button mushrooms.
Yeah,
in
those
the can.
No good mushrooms that I would never buy now. So when he showed me that, it just changed my life. Like I was like, wow, there got to be, this is chanterelles. There got to be more out there. And I spent all my time out picking and finding out what was more. And I was never the type to ever want to go to university, but I definitely did a buttload of research on mushrooms, figuring out where they grow, what trees species they grow under, what time of year they come out, like south facing hills, and it just took me down a rabbit hole that I've never been able to get out of.
Did it take a while for you to get over your mother's commandments not to go to mushrooms?
No, but family and friends would never eat them at first.
Oh,
this
really?
Was 10, 15 years ago, and I was always picking stuff, but I'd bring home mushrooms and try to get mother to cook them, and there'd be no doing that. And it took me 6 years to convince the farmer's market to let me sell mushrooms.
To let you sell mushrooms.
There's a rule, there's no mushroom sales. With chefs, like, they had a responsibility to know what they're cooking. You go sell a mushroom to a chef at a restaurant, they should know what you're cooking before they ever serve it to somebody.
Yeah.
Like, I'm certified now to pick walnuts, but you're selling it to the public, they're kind of just in the dark. Like, you're selling them a mushroom, and they got to take your word that it's your mushroom, and they don't really know about it, so they go home and cook it. So it took them a long time to convince them, like, I've done my homework, I've done my research.
How do you get certified as a...
It was a thing through ServiceNL. They just came up with a little thing where you had to identify mushrooms and where you have the Latin names and where they grow. It was
sort of food safety, so you'd know what was... You said you always grew up foraging, but is there a point where you said this could be a life, right?
I think it was that very moment my friend Tate would pick a mushrooms. The first time he took me to pick chanterelles and show me where they were and what trees they grow under, and I was just completely infatuated with it. That's all I wanted to do. Every spare minute I got, I would be in the woods looking for mushrooms and get home and reading about mushrooms. And it kind of took over my life for a little bit. It still is in a way.
So you've been going back to the same places maybe for a dozen years or so.
Yeah, at least. Yeah. Trick is, like, you really got to leave a lot of that mushroom in the ground. So, like, when you find a patch of chanterelles, what you're really picking is the fruiting body from the mushroom coming up, what people call a mushroom.
Yeah.
So the mushroom itself is the mushroom underneath that. Like, all the mycelium, that is the mushroom. And then the fruiting bodies are coming up under trigger. So if you just go pick every fruiting body and don't leave anything to spread spores, and and I always use a knife, which I found, which I read about. When you don't, a lot of times you can pull up a lot of the root, leave mycelium with it. So I figured that, like, the least amount of imprint you're making in on that patch, like, I try to leave at least 50% when I find a patch, maybe even more sometimes because a lot more people are into it now. So if someone come behind you pick some.
Yeah.
So you really don't want to clear cut any mushroom patch that you find. There's a lot of little tricks that you can use, like using baskets works so good because you're actually spreading spores as you're walking around.
A
few years ago when people were getting them, I've seen a lot of people in the woods with plastic bags, and I would always plug these and try to tell them, like, you're not going to spread anything, there's no spores being dropped. And I find a lot when I find a patch, I'm not just trancing around the whole thing just because it's like the mushroom is underneath. So if you're just walking around, like, even a footprint can make a difference in the wilderness or in nature. I try to just plant my feet and put my arms out and try to get as much as I can, and then go on the outside of the patch, and just being conscientious, really. You want that to be there next year and every year. If anything, I notice probably with our weather changing then too, but I don't know if it's using the baskets and everything and correctly picking that there's more mushrooms in the patches that I've been.
You're basically kind of seeding as you go.
I would hope so. That's what I would always think. Yeah, there's a lot of things to keep in mind, but it's not rocket science.
Is there a time when the mushroom is ripe, so to speak?
For sure. Yeah. Like chanterelles, like when they're out in the, you see the cap is kind of curled, and you'll know that the spores would have been dropped. A lot of times you can see like spore dropping from a mushroom.
Yeah, okay.
They all happen at so many different times too,
right?
Like chanterelles are more of a summer. Like in my head, they were always in the beginning of August, you would go pick mushrooms. But now with our summers, I was picking at the end of June this year. So depending what mushroom you're talking about, for most of the summer, it's a lot just chanterelles. And then when we get the rain and the cold nights, then you'll get into all the interesting mushrooms like winter chanterelles and hedgehogs.
Right.
And even some mushrooms take frost to trigger like fluids and stuff like that. Yeah.
Because the infamous mushroom foray that happens annually tends to be in the fall though.
September usually. And it is the fun, in my opinion, the funnest weekend of the year. It's so fun. Like, there's so many people out.
What happens at a mushroom foray?
At a mushroom foray.
Oh, I see.
No, I'm joking. It's pretty much a public science experiment where, like, people like myself who like mushrooms and want to learn more will pay to go to this event. And then they'll fly in mycologists and other specialists and people that are in the lichens and stuff like that. to Newfoundland for that time. Then you send everybody out and pick whatever mushrooms you can and try to identify it the best you can. And then you take it back to the 4A, wherever we have them. The Shores at Bishop Falls at the Maxim's camp. And we take them back, identify them, and they do little like workshops to help people identify them and things like that. So by the end of it, they try and catalog all the mushrooms and put them in the library. And every year they find new species. It's how they know what mushrooms are in Newfoundland. And that's why they do it in so many different spots around. Yeah. So they figured out a lot of the fungi in Newfoundland from these 4As. Yeah.
As always on this show, I asked my guest for a song choice, and we went back and forth on some possibilities, including an obscure mushroom song that we never were able to find, kind of like my experience in looking for obscure mushrooms themselves. But we settled on this great jam, which talks about the noble and healthy tradition of eating weeds, this time in the southern U.S.
Some of y'all never been down south too much. I'm gonna tell you a little bit about this so that you understand what I'm talking about. Down there we have a plant that grows out in the woods and the fields. Looks something like a turnip green. Everybody calls it poke salad. Poke salad. Used to know a girl lived down there and she'd go out in the evenings and pick her a mess of it. Carry it home and cook it to supper. Cause that's about all they had to eat. They did all right. And down in Louisiana, where the alligators grow so mean, they lived a girl that I swear to the world made the alligators look tame. Poke salad, Annie. Everybody said it was a shame, cause her mama was working on a chain gang. A mean, vicious woman. Every day for supper time, she'd go down by the truck patch and pick her mess of poke salad. Home in a tote sack. Poke salad, Annie. The gator's got your granny. Chomp, chomp, chomp. Everybody said it was a sham, cause her mama was working on changing. A wretched, spiteful, straight razor tote moment. Lord, I must pick my mess up.
That was Tony Joe White with his song Poke Salad Annie, as suggested by my guest Sean Dawson. We're talking about being creative with foraged foods. If you want more details on some of the topics Sean covers, check out his fine book called The Forager's Dinner, Finding, Harvesting, and Preparing Newfoundland Labrador's Edible Plants. Let's head back to our conversation.
So how did you move from mushrooms to broader teas and...
I was always pretty into that.
You're always
Labrador tea, and I've been into sting nettles for a long time, like making sting nettle tea, because it's such a good anti-inflammatory. Like, Newfoundlanders are obsessed with tea, but I always hated Tetley, and I was never a tea guy, but I love nettle teas and herbal teas and chaga tea and all those type of things.
Chaga tea, so that's the growth on the birch? Is
that it's a fungus that comes out on birch trees. It'll usually start in a crack or a wound in a tree. Usually at more mature birches where you'll find it, but the spores will get into a crack or a wound, and it'll take many years to grow. That mycelium will start growing inside a tree, and about 4 or 5 years it'll meet the exterior of the tree, and then it will slowly grow. Then you'll find these big cankers. They almost look like charcoal on the outside of the tree. And that one I always pick in the winter because the tree's dormant. And never take the stuff on the inside of the tree, where I was saying the mycelium takes a while to grow to the exterior. You want to cut it off flush. It's a really slow growing mushroom, so you don't want to just go pick everything you see as well. And a little bit can do you a long way. You can reboil the same chunk 4 or 5 times. So even the smallest amount will last a long time.
Do you try to grind it up or somehow?
No, I didn't when I originally got into it, but I just started chunking it up. I'll do like an inch by inch chunk, and that'll be kind of like your tea bag, and then you put on a simmer, like a medium high boil. It takes 45 minutes to an hour for your tea to turn really black, and that's you know that the medicinal value is out. There's not much flavor in it until you really slowly boil it. It will get really flavorful. It's one of the only things with natural vanilla in it, besides chocolate.
Oh, really?
So it'll start to give off mocha coffee taste, a little bit like black tea, kind of a bit of mushroom flavor, but not much. I miss it when I don't have it every day now. It's full of antioxidants, anti-inflammatories, it's got fiber in it, it's got vitamin D in in it, which most things don't have.
You wrote a famous book a couple years back. So what's the response been to your book about foraging?
It's been really great. When I was at the gas station yesterday getting propane for the furnace, and I was like, oh, you're Foss Man Dandy Cabbage. That's like my Instagram name. And he said, man, I've gotten so into harvesting my own food. And like, I love hearing that stuff, right? Because people weren't interested in that when I was growing up.
No.
It was not a thing, and now it's becoming a thing. People want to know where their food comes from now.
Yeah.
Like, when I was as a kid eating a chicken nugget, I never even thought of it as a chicken, you know? Like, or a hamburger. You don't think of the animal behind it or what goes into it.
Yeah.
So a lot more people are thinking about where their food comes from. They want it to come from Newfoundland. They don't want it to be sprayed with pesticides and herbicides and all these things that take forever to get here, and it still makes it look pristine. Yeah, I've noticed a huge shift. A lot of it's happened mostly because of the restaurants, I'm sure of it, because like Newfoundland has made all this stuff pretty famous, like mushrooms and all the great chefs showing you that it doesn't have to be famine food, is what I'm trying to say. Like, they'll do the most beautiful things with sting nettles and watercress and dandelions and dandelion roots. It really inspired me to want to inspire people, to teach people and do foraging tours and write this book.
You refer to famine food.
Yeah, a lot of people will call like this stuff like dandelions and chickweed. Yeah. Like, when I first started telling people about chickweed, people just absolutely hated it. Like, I worked at my friend, helped my friend at her bed and breakfast in Pooch Cove, and I'd be serving guest salads. I would always do the salads. I'd be making chickweed salads, and they'd be like, chickweed? Like, I've been picking this out of my garden since I was a kid. I hate this stuff. And then you get them to eat it with a nice vinaigrette, and it's my favorite salad green of all time. It's so tasty. It's a bit peppery. It's really crunchy. It's like a lot of these things are just quotation weeds, you know, but they're really better than some of the vegetables you're growing. Something like sedum tastes like cabbage to me. A lot of people call it stone crop. I start making kimchi with it.
Have you ever tasted something you didn't like?
I'm sure I have. I'm not picky, though. That's a good thing about me. Yeah, I've definitely made some things with wild food that were complete failures, for sure. Some things just don't work. I mean, even some mushrooms, like matsutake, which is like the most, they say, expensive mushroom in the world. And when I first found those in Newfoundland, I freaked out. I was like, this is amazing. I can't wait to try these. And I went home, and they taste like my dad's hockey bag. Like, that's what smell and taste that came to me. I just fried them up like chanterelles. And I was like, oh, I don't like these at all. And then my friend from Japan, I showed her that I found them. She was so excited. Yeah. And I told her how I cooked them. She said, no, these just need a little bit of searing. Use oil instead of butter, a little bit of soy sauce, a bit of fish sauce, and really nice in sesame oil or something like that. Then I tried it like that, and I was like, wow, this is my favorite mushroom. So it's just about how you cook things. So a lot of times someone will try something, be like, I don't like that. Like, I don't like nettle tea, but try maybe making cream of nettle soup. You probably have a whole different aspect from it.
What's the trick with nettles?
I love them so much. It's one of the first things that come up in the spring when you're treating nettles. You want to wear gloves. Yeah. A little hairs. If you look in the microscope, there's a little bead of liquid on every little hair, and it's a little bead of toxin. And when that penetrates your skin, it has a reaction with it.
Okay.
Like, the toxins get in.
Yeah.
So wear gloves, and if you dry nettles, the sting will go away. If you blanch them, that's usually what I do when I'm cooking, making a sting nettle soup or pesto. Not even just a 30, 45 second blanch, then you put them right in a nice bath to keep that nice green color and stop the cooking. And then you could do whatever with it.
Yeah.
You freeze them and use them as anywhere you would use spinach. Like, you could use it.
Yeah. You mentioned working with chefs and that being very important. Well, what has that taught you about foraging? Just dealing with people who are thinking about food in a slightly different way.
It's what inspired me to keep going with it and wanting to make a career and teach people how this. Just to see how passionate these guys are. Like, when you go in and you bring them something, and years ago, like, I'd be going to Raymond's, and Celeste would be like, can you get me some dandelion roots? I'm like, what are you doing with that? And then she'd be like, tell me, you roast them, they really taste like coffee. And then I would make like dandelion lattes, which would blow people's mind. Yeah, they really pushed me to keep going, like dandelion capers and
dandelion capers.
Yeah, like, you pick the buds in the spring
and you use
lacto-fermentum.
Just
one tablespoon of salt for one cup of water, and then you just let them sit in room temperature, and then they start fermenting. You burp them every day by taking the lid off your jar. In 3-4 days time, they're shelf stable, and for a few months at least, and they taste just like capers. So there's like so many things like that that just blew my mind. And like the alder, like, you see the alder here? That's the male catkins. That's what I'm picking now. If you smell your hand, they smell really florally, really peppery, and I'd be bringing them into Raymond's and Ross would be telling me to be making pepper with them, and I'd be like, pepper? Like, what the hell? And I'd try it, and it's really peppery, a nice florally taste, and then I'd start making it and sell it to the farmer's market, and the more research I do, I find out alder is like one of the biggest sources of protein we have here on the island. So it's like, if you start using that in your food, like, and you don't maybe not need to buy as much meat, or a lot of vegans and vegetarians now, so it's just, there's no end to it. It's like, there's so much you can do, and then even stuff I do with it that I never heard of, like, I've got into making mustards last year, and I started making alder Dijon mustards, and it's like a book that I opened that I can't ever put down. Daddy was lazy and no count.
claimed he had a bad back. All her brothers were fit for stealing watermelons out of my truck. That you broke Sally Danny. The gator's got your granny. Everybody said it was a shame, 'cause her mama's a wicked on a chain gang. Suck a little poke salad to me. You know I need me a mess of it.
That was Poke Salad Annie by Tony Joe White, one of the songs that my guest today, Sean Dawson, suggested. He knows a thing or two, or 50, about greens that many think are weeds, but that are tasty and full of nutrition. We start out this last section of our chat by talking about his work as a tour guide.
You do tours as well.
Yep, do tours, which go over really good. I've done them at Murray's since the Grounds Cafe opened. Yep. We start in May, and we start doing the spring shoots, and we go right till about October, November, depending on the season, and go right into the mushrooms. Yep. They show up at the cafe, and I take people through the gardens center and show them a lot of the disturbed area where, like, as soon as you disturb a piece of ground, all these weeds come back to replenish the ground and try to give it nutrients and everything it needs to become back into grass and back into forest. And so by eating all those things, you're getting all the different nutrients that these plants are offering. Then I walk up through the farm area and I show them the weeds that grow in a lot of people's gardens. A lot of people are pretty floored by that because they know all the things. Like, they're out there, they're my hosta bed. And then I tell them that you can actually eat hostas, and they blow their mind.
You can't eat hostas.
Hostas is my favorite spring food.
What part of the hosta?
The shoot. You know how when the hosta shoot, it looks like a little crown that's rolled up really tight?
Yeah.
That tastes just like bok choy. And then when the leaves open, they get more tender and a little bitter. And the first time I tried a hosta, that was a bit of a revolution too. It's like, it's insane how good this is. And like places in Asia still grow it as a vegetable, but in North America, it's just an ornamental plant. I remember I brought them down to Mallard Cottage, and right when the lobsters were season was on the go. And Todd was like, looking at me like, are you crack? Like, hostas. And then he brought them up right in front of me, tasted them, and that week it was hostas and lobsters on the menu. Then I take them to the boreal setting, like through the woods, and show them, like, the mushrooms when they're out, but, like, the creeping snowberries, and get them to taste the leaves, and, like...
What do they taste like, though?
Little tic-tac. Yeah. They look like little white tic-tacs, and they taste a lot like a tic-tac. I'm sure the tic-tac was modeled from it, but if you ever had a wintergreen berry, it tastes just like
just
that.
Like a
Got, like, a minty root beer type of feel, and if you eat the leaves, they taste the very same. Like, I put the leaves often in, like, lamb roasts and stuff like that. Then, take them up and show them the berries, and then there's, like, an old homestead up there. Like, a lot of foraging I do is, like, people are like, hey, where are you getting plums and damsons and stuff in the wild? Yeah. But, like, a lot of the Europeans, when they came, they brought over plums and damsons, and they spread, and now they don't live in those places anymore, so, like, they are almost, like, wild now. Yeah. Show them the old homesteads, and show them the old wild hops and all that stuff. Take them back, and then Cam Murray built me a fire pit this year, so I'll come back and I'll actually cook all the things we're talking about on the fire pit and give everyone a little tasting, and a baker at the grounds will bake them some bread and make a treat, and I'll make pestos and mushroom pickles, and it's a lot of fun.
Is there something that makes your day, like something that you find?
Definitely, rare. Man. Anytime I find something rare, new, when I go find a new piece of woods in a new spot, like, that makes my day. Like, years ago, everyone thought apple trees were all crab apples, but you go taste an apple that you find in the wild, and man, this is a Honeycrisp. That makes my day. I do a lot of traveling for foraging too. Like, I always wanted to eat fiddleheads, but I know that the fiddleheads here are carcinogenic, the brackens. They're mostly what we have on Avalon. They're really papery looking. And then I went to the West Coast for a trip, and I realized, I was like, man, these are all ostrich ferns. I was like, I had no idea they even grew in Newfoundland. That made my month. Whenever I find a new plant or a new way to utilize a plant, even seaweed, I was picking seaweed for some of the restaurants years ago in the winter and started pickling it, and they came out really good. And then I started doing that and selling them at the market, calling them sea olives. A lot of people thought that was pretty cool.
Seaweed and those sweet peas that are down by the sea.
Yeah, there's
kind of
so
stuff.
Much good beach
stuff. So what, was that ever something that people ate very much at all?
It was always on the beaches here, but no one knew to eat it. It wasn't until those awesome chefs and restaurants went and probably worked in BC and figured out, like, they were doing it there or somewhere else, and then they came back to Newfoundland and started using it here. So there's so much dulse around, and even there's sea lettuce for making salads. And
the sea cucumber, is that a is that
sea cucumber? That's gotten huge. Yeah. My buddy does it up in Garnish. They're shipping a lot of that.
Can you cultivate that or
I'm not sure. Like he tells me when he dives for it, some spots in the water you can't see nothing else but sea cucumbers. As long as you harvest it right and, you know, you don't overfish or hunt things. Yeah. Hopefully when something comes out, they realize that sea cucumber is marketable, that they realize that you don't have to farm it, but if you sustainably harvest it, it'll always be here.
Yeah. We've been talking mostly plants, but you have a bit of a background in animals too. You've had chickens before, you said?
Yes. I moved to Torbay a long time ago, and when I moved down here, I got chickens and ducks. And then I went down to my friend's bed and breakfast down in Pooch Cove, and I started helping her, and she had goats and chickens and all that. Yeah. I raised some pigs down there, and I started raising quails, which I have quails back here now. But I've always been an animal nut.
Do you get into hunting at all?
I hunt rabbits and stuff time of year. Yeah. I grew up hunting rabbits and stuff with my uncle, and my dad gets his license every 4 years. I don't have myself have an FAC, but I go with him every 4 years, lend a hand, and I trade a lot of stuff for wild game. I try to eat as much wild game as I can. Like, I am eating a lot of rabbits now this time of year.
Do you have a root cellar here?
No, I'm building one this spring. I just cleared that land where it was all knotweed. I'm taking care of that now. And another thing that I eat a lot, I love knotweed.
Okay, so how do you
When I moved here, right on the side there's all knotweed, and people were like, oh man, what are you going to do? Yeah, I get stressed out. Like, I love knotweed.
You eat the shoots, the small shoots?
Yeah,
the asparagus flavors?
Yeah, they say when I start reading about it, like I said, you go down a rabbit hole with all this foraging things. And when I first read about knotweed, I was like, wow, you can eat that? I started reading about it, and it was like, yeah, if you harvest it 15 centimeters tall, use it like asparagus. And in the spring, I was waiting for it to get about 15 centimeters tall, and it grows very fast. It's a mile a minute, so like you can almost watch it grow. Yeah. And I tried it, and it was, not everything's a success. And I was, this is gross. Like, this does not taste like asparagus. It's sour, and it's right fibrous at that stage, 15 centimeters tall. I was like, no, knotweed's not for me. No pun intended.
Yeah, great.
So next year, I was out picking nettles and stuff, and I seen the knotweed coming out. It was just little pink crowns coming out of the ground. You could just see the tips, and I started moving the debris around, and it actually grows like from the root. It hadn't seen the sun yet, so it was whitish pink. It's like a leek. When it sees the sun, it turns green and then grows really fast. So I went home and I tried that part. So much tastier, and it reminded me more like of a rhubarb, but a bit more sour. Yeah. So I started making like chutneys and jams and things like that with it instead of using it like asparagus. And then I was like, wow, this is exceptional. Like, it's really, really good. I really like them, and I start making pickles with them.
Yeah. So you have to get them pretty early then, I guess.
Yeah, really early. Like really I said, you just see the crowns come up, you dig them out from the root, and then you crack them off.
What's your favorite food?
Oh, that's a hard one. I am a mushroom fanatic, I do love anything with mushrooms. It's hard to say. It depends on the season. Yeah. Like, I can't wait for the spring to come here and start picking nettles. And dandelion salad, before the dandelions get bitter, just dandelions and basic vinaigrette. Yeah. Just a nice dandelion salad. Yeah. It's nothing better. First couple salads you have in here, it honestly makes me feel like Popeye. It's just like eating the spinach. Like, there's something that it does to you. Foraging wasn't a huge thing in Newfoundland, but Newfoundlanders did always harvest dandelions. That was my big memory. My nan would send me out picking dandelion greens in the spring, and she would blanch them, put them away for Sunday dinner. Kind of use them like a turnip top. But eating in season is so healthy. That is such a smart thing to do. Yeah. Like I said, like each thing that's coming up, each weed is trying to replenish land and give it something else that it needs. So if you're eating all those, you're getting all the different variety of vitamins and things like that. Grocery stores are really what cause people to have dietary issues. Yeah. Like a lot of people I know, like their only vegetables are tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, onions, and sometimes garlic, like if they're getting adventurous. Right. And that's what they go get at the grocery store, maybe some apples and stuff. But if you get into foraging and you're like going to make wintercress taste good, and you're going to get into the nettles and the dandelions and then hostas, and man, you're getting things that your body never even had before. And like if you're just doing that all season long, you're going to be pretty healthy. So by relying on a grocery store, you're not as creative. You don't go to the grocery store and I'm like, I'm going to turn this into a caper.
Thanks for taking some time. And it's wonderful to chat with you about this and all
really
this
great
stuff.
To meet you.
I'm going to look at the hostas in our garden in a different way.
That's what it takes. It takes looking at this stuff in a different way. We were taught to mow down all the dandelions, not leave them for the bees, not eat them. Different taste, different outlook.
And the knotweed revolution.
Knotweed revolution. Yeah. It's coming. It's here, actually. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Yeah, no sweat. Like each thing that's coming up, each weed is trying to replenish land and give it something else that it needs. So if you're eating all those, you're getting all the different variety of vitamins. I try to eat as much wild game as I can. Like, I am eating a lot of rabbits now this time of year. When you start foraging, you don't want to just switch your diet just to foraging, because you'll be on the toilet all the time. Hoss is my favorite spring food. Tastes just like bok choy. Alder is like one of the biggest sources of protein we have here on the island.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of the show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. To send me a message, email me at iemke@grenfell.mun.ca. For music on today's show, we heard Louisiana native Tony Joe White with his southern advice about the value of using weeds called Poke Salad Annie. The theme music, Cuckold Hen, was performed this week by a group that sounds like they maybe spend some time foraging in the forests themselves, the Backwoods Hucksters. This show was made possible by a grant from the Community Radio Fund of Canada and is produced by the Voice of Bombay Radio Network and Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time. I'll be right here. Happy trails.
Knotweed is a superfood. It's so full of so many good things for you. Knotweed revolution. Yeah. It's coming. It's here, actually.